Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian podcast that's going to have a bonus live evening episode in New York City on April 25th. Go to reason.com/events and purchase a ticket right now before they run out. I am Matt Welch, joined by the traditional starting lineup of Nick Gillespie, a returning Peter Suderman like Hank Greenberg after the war, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hi, friends.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Hey, Matt.
That's right. Well, Nick, good thing you don't have any events scheduled in Midtown Manhattan tonight.
Yeah, that's
because,
right.
Because
you got that right, babe.
Because we're doing some chatter. We're doing some pepper here.
And you know, you listed me first in the starting lineup, and I feel like Omar Moreno.
Yes,
Matt Welch, an overestimated leadoff hitter who really.
And
just was not very
yet
good.
Another Pittsburgh reference early in the podcast.
I hate the Pirates, especially that vintage.
Wake up, Catherine.
What?
Former president and a former New York resident, Donald J. Trump, is coming back to Trump Tower this very afternoon. We record these things, by the way, people, on Monday mornings. You receive them on Monday afternoon. He's coming back to prepare for his long tease and actually now happening arraignment in a Manhattan criminal court on Tuesday, reportedly for dozens of charges related to him paying off porn actress Stormy Daniels $130,000 to keep quiet about the two of them making sexy time. This is, as you will be hearing often, the very first time a former U.S. president has faced criminal charges after leaving office. It would have probably happened to Richard Nixon, but his former vice president, Gerald Ford, granted him a very controversial, in its day, preemptive pardon. It's also likely not to be Trump's last time in the docket. The Justice Department has special counsel Jack Smith, if that's his real name, looking into Trump's mishandling of classified documents, his connection to the January 6th riots, and also his Stop the Steal fundraising activities. Didn't realize that was a thing, but that's going on too. Meanwhile, a grand jury in Fulton County, Georgia, is still investigating Trump's pressure on state officials there to overturn the results of the 2020 election. The former president has unsurprisingly been going ballistic over on Truth Social, among other things, warning of, quote, death and destruction. Sorry.
Don't just laugh, man.
Should this day come to pass, my heart is and soul are dead, as you know, Catherine. This day has indeed come to pass. So, Catherine, Reason doesn't like presidents. Reason also doesn't like politicized prosecutors, especially in New York. What are some libertarian insights into this case that, say, our non-libertarian listeners would do very well to keep in mind?
Yeah, I think that the main thing that jumps out for me is how much special treatment Trump is receiving in every single dimension of this case. So I was reading this morning one of those, you know, what you need to know about the Trump indictment things, because I was trying to get ready for this here podcast. And he probably won't be handcuffed. He probably won't have a mugshot taken. He probably won't walk out the front doors of the courtroom after the official proceedings are over, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He's getting a bunch of special treatment at the court. Of course, he's also gotten a bunch of special negative treatment in the form of this case, right? In the form of any of this rising to the level at all. And I think that unfortunately, a lesson that a lot of people might take, and appropriately so, is that maybe, you know, Lady Justice is not blind. Maybe there actually is just a tremendous amount of political motivation and bias and special treatment that happens in our courtrooms all the time. We will see some of that on display. My other thought, just a small one, is this is the proof that we learned nothing from Bill Clinton. This is Trump's dumbest crime. If he did crimes, this is his dumbest crime. This is his least consequential crime. We probably don't even think hush money should be illegal. We probably don't even think campaign finance rules should exist. And here we are fussing about this stuff. Here we are fussing about, you know, the equivalent of a blowjob and lying under oath when really, really genuinely terrible things happened under his presidency. And we may get to those, as you said, but this is what we're doing first, and that's not going to be helpful to anyone.
Nick, you're a doctor of literature. as I recall from my recurring dreams of
and of heartbreak, Matt.
I have recurring dreams of going back to, this is true, of my high school English class, but that I've failed it and I'd forgotten to show up. So perhaps related to that is that I recall from high school English that one definition of tragedy is when every character within it is acting according to his or her own sort of internal logic and moral code, which then conflicts with those of other people. And then before you know it, you're at the end of a really bad Doors song and it's just terrible for everybody. Is what we are experiencing right now a tragedy? Or is it a farce or some other genre of literature that you're going to share with us?
Yeah. Perhaps opera buffa, buffo, which I don't really understand what that is. But I do, just before we get into actual substantive things, Trump on his personal social media platform did write, these thugs and radical left monsters have just indicated the 45th president of the United States of America. And I,
in my mind, that's, so, you know, that meme of the guy just holding out his hands, great. Like, he's right here.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's like when actors are so, like, you're indicating, amazing. You know, because you're supposed to just actually sell the emotion rather than kind of spell it out with your face.
But this indication, this indicament, you know, is, as Catherine was saying, is, on every level, is abnormal and weird. And it's the type of thing that may actually change the course of politics and culture and history. And it wouldn't have happened in most other circumstances, even to a former politician, et cetera, et cetera. And I think we, you know, what Trump, for me, the relevance of this or the significance of all of this is that Trump has always, you know, since he emerged into serious politics in 2015, he has had this incredible, he's like an accelerant in a fire or something like that. We were already trending towards loss of trust and confidence and belief in our institutions and the people who run them. And he just has, he continues to burn things to the ground, because it is true that, you know, if he did what he did and lied about it, he should be held accountable. If he really shouldn't be at the same time for any of these particular things, you know, there's that broader argument, which I've seen a bunch of people saying, you know, that Bush, Obama, Trump, and Biden have all, you know, they've killed millions of people in various aspects, you know, in various kinds of war. And this is what we're talking about. You know, there seems to be something vastly, vastly wrong. By the same token, Republicans who are saying, you know, this is an abomination, blah, blah, blah. And why haven't we locked up Hillary Clinton yet? You know, Trump is Loki, and not the Marvel Comics Loki. He is the Norse god of chaos and discord. And he constantly is reflecting back to us. You know, he's just like a water sprinkler system that is just spitting acid. And every time, you know, you some of it gets on your pants and burns through that. Some of it gets on your skin and burns through it. He just has this incredible knack for showing how awful and fake almost all of our institutions are. And we have to deal with it. We have to contain that problem and start moving on from this. And I think this is just going to extend the worst aspects of a kind of political culture war mentality for another 5 to 10 years.
Catherine, I hope that you are keeping a sort of a metaphor diagramming thing there.
I don't know. Loki sprinkler that. Got on my pants and now I don't know what to do.
Loki is nothing if not the god of lawn care. So I think I'm in the right universe.
Peter, help us here. I understand that you're from Florida. The governor there, Ron Seth Mancusonius, whatever his name is now, Ron DeSantis, last week reacted to this by blasting the Soros elected district attorney Alvin Bragg and saying that he would refuse any order to extradite the president. What do you make of that? And also, perhaps relatedly, what lessons are there, if any, to be gleaned from what seems to be the fact now that Trump's popularity among Republicans is spiking as a direct result of this indictment?
Well, it does seem like there may be some politics involved in this legal prosecution here, this case. You know, it's hard to say. You know, I figure it's just the law in a lot of ways, but it does seem like there may end up being some political ramifications and some people who treat this primarily as a political prosecution. So look, my kind of basic take on this is obviously no president is above the law, but it does not give me any hope at all that explainery type articles in the New York Times with like analysis style headlines like what we know about the indictment and surrender of Donald Trump are constantly front-loading disclaimers to the effect of this is like a novel legal theory. No one's ever really tried this before. It's untested, right? Like while the facts are dramatic and the indictment explosive, the case against Mr. Trump could hinge on untested legal theory. A conviction is far from assured. That's paragraph 4, right? Like this is in the New York Times. The New York Times is like, we don't really know. Like this doesn't really seem like much of a case in the real sense. It's because it's not much of a case in the real sense based on what we know. I guess I would just sort of caution people, you know, sort of not to take that too far because the indictment is still sealed. There are several dozen charges, apparently. We don't know the extent and specifics of them, so we should withhold judgment to some extent. But in some ways, Nick, you know, I basically just agree with Nick's point that this sort of aggravating nonsense, this sort of just moronic partisan bickering and back and forth and weaponization of the law and of every aspect of it is bound to continue so long as Donald Trump is a player in our national politics. And if you want to get rid of this and you want to find you want this to not be part of our politics, then you are going to have to we're going to have to get past Donald Trump somehow or another. And in fact, I fear that it may be too late for that. And there was a really sort of worrying op-ed in the New York Times opinion section over the weekend by, I'm going to mispronounce this name, but Ankush Kardori, a former federal prosecutor, who again says, you know, we don't know how this is going to go. The case here is quite unusual, raises novel legal issues, and like the key witness seems to be Michael Cohen, who is pretty much by his own admission a completely unreliable scammer, right? But the thing that this piece is about is that it may end up sparking a partisan tit for tat, in which every time someone there is a former president from an opposition party. Prosecutors at the local level who are looking to make a name for themselves nationally go and look for what can we charge this person with? And if you are inclined toward a libertarian view of the law, you know there is almost certainly something that anybody who is involved in a lot of money and a lot of politics and like a lot of public life, almost certainly something that you can charge someone with. And that seems to have been what happened here, is that they went out with a thing where they heard, oh, look, this guy committed a really serious crime and we need to charge him. Instead, it seems like this guy is what happened was they thought this guy is a bad guy. He seems like he probably did something wrong. Let's go look through his books and look through his records and see if we can find that he did something wrong. And they found something that they can now claim is maybe wrong based on a novel and unusual legal theory. And that doesn't seem like a great way to conduct politics in a democracy.
Catherine, speaking of fishing expeditions, I have heard a lot of people in defense of Alvin Bragg say, how dare you, sir, insult the work of our fine independent grand juries. Can you shed some light on why a civil libertarian might treat grand juries somewhat with skepticism?
Yeah, so this is, I mean, it's related to what Peter just said, that you know, there is a kind of fishing expedition element to some of this. And in general, I now have become like if somebody claims that a panel or or commission or investigation is an independent investigation. I now just assume that that means highly politicized and goal-oriented. Maybe that's too cynical, but this is, you know, this is one of many, many things that folks could find if they go looking in Donald Trump's papers and records. It's not surprising that they found something. I don't know. Yeah. I think like cynicism is an appropriate response here.
Grand juries systems, which is, you know, enumerated in the Constitution, it was set up initially to make sure that civilians had some input on the exercise of power by prosecutors. And it has just been marvelously inverted over the years to be a system in which prosecutors are the ones who call all of the shots. There is no defense attorney present at a grand jury in general, because people have not been charged with a crime yet. They're still investigating, and they have investigative powers that normal criminal prosecutions do not have. They can make you testify, and if you don't, they can send you to jail. That's what happened all throughout the Balco-related Barry Bonds cases. The people who served prison time were all the people who refused to testify. It wasn't people who committed underlying crimes for the most part. It is it's remarkable how much investigative power that they have, and they serve at the discretion of the prosecutor. Nick, there was a tweet this morning I'm very excited to share with you. It comes from...
And on this tweet, the world, the balance of the world holds, man,
yes,
or something hangs.
Speaking of presidential...
This tweet, by who?
Thanks. Former Ambassador John Bolton saying... This is actually...
Who has been supplanted as having the greatest mustache in public life with the premiere of Pinball, The Man Who Saved the Game, the movie by the Bragg brothers, not related to Alvin Bragg.
Absolutely correct on all counts. John Bolton was on Face the Nation this weekend. And on Face the Nation, when asked about this case, had the following quote, which he has helpfully put in quotation marks on his Twitter account this morning. It's important to stress that in this case that involves hush-hush money to a porn star to cover up an affair that later involves cooking his company's books, you have not heard a single Trump defender stand up and say, oh, that's not the Donald Trump I know. And it goes to the question of character and fitness for the presidency. So my question to you, Nick Gillespie, is do you just got to hand it to John Bolton?
You know, ever since he was on that, he was on Fox and Friends, and he used that that plastic platform that you swivel your hips on.
Oh God, yes.
That was a yeah. That is, you know, I still have nightmares about that, Matt Walsh. So my favorite tweet about all of this was somebody who said, "Star of Home Alone 2 indicted by a grand jury in New York City," meaning Donald Trump. I don't know what you mean by hand it to John Bolton. He's another kind of excrescence of the past decade that needs to be taken out of American politics. We're not getting anywhere. Yeah. We have officially reached. Do you remember the great early 90s web site Jump the Shark? Matt Welch, you know, which, I mean, that phrase no longer gets used anymore, but it tracked TV shows in the exact moment when they started really sucking. And there was a whole subsection devoted to Ted McGinley, the actor. And it was, you know, when Ted McGinley showed up on your show, like it included The Love Boat and Happy Days and Married with Children. It was like, it was beyond over. Like you not have just jumped the shark. You have been eaten by the shark and excreted by the shark and eaten again. That's where we are in American politics right now.
I just think that the internet jumped the shark ever since the hamster dance faded from collective memory.
That's true.
Memory.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. We're going to move on. Last week on this podcast, we discussed ongoing anxieties related to the development of artificial intelligence. It's as if we read Elon Musk's mind. That's because the squirrely South African, after we posted the program, joined his name to a splashy and alarmist open letter warning that, quote, AI systems with human competitive intelligence can pose profound risks to society and humanity. and that therefore on all AI labs, all AI labs should immediately pause for at least 6 months the training of AI systems more powerful than GPT-4. I totally know what that is. And that if they don't, then, quote, governments should step in and institute a moratorium, retorted Reason science correspondent Ron Bailey. It's a bad idea and won't work anyway. Peter, I know you were itching to join our AI conversation last week. Why don't you start off by steel manning, if you can, a little bit, some of the concerns out there, since we might have been a little bit dismissive here last week, and then hopefully in a concise fashion, adding your own two cents.
Obviously, these issues are complex and difficult to distill in a short podcast segment or even a very long one. If you like search through the podcast world right now, it's just all...
Is this a chat GPT?
No, it's really just
talking?
Me. It's just like two-hour discussions about AI risks. You're going to like learn about AI alignment issues and instrumental convergence and all of these like great terms about how AIs work and what people are afraid of. But I think you can kind of distill the concerns that AI doomers have into two primary elements. And the first one is nanobots, and the second one is paperclips. And very specifically, they're concerned that AI will turn all of us mere humans into paperclips. Now, again, I'm distilling and exaggerating, and I'm being a little bit goofy for effect here. But in fact, this is one of the most famous hypotheticals about runaway AI, is that you give AI a goal, not just AI, I should say AGI, and this is actually important, artificial general intelligence, because AI is narrow and only has one specific purpose. You can think of the chess AIs that we've been working with for several years. Artificial general intelligence can be directed towards a task, but it goes about those tasks in a way that has something resembling a human-like sense of learning capacity. They're based on neural networks that are built not exactly structurally like human minds, but built to replicate in some sense the way that humans learn. And so they have a capacity to learn many, many things, right? But then you give it a goal. And so what if you gave an AI a goal of build paperclips really efficiently? Well, because it's an AI and it's smarter than humans, otherwise why would we be using it, right? Obviously, it has to be smarter than humans to have value, right, in this sense, right? And so it's smarter than humans. And so what it decides is two things. One is, well, how could I fail at that? The easiest way for an AGI to fail at building paperclips really well would be for someone to shut it off. So the first thing it does is it starts in ways that we won't necessarily understand for two reasons. One, because AGI is actually, we don't really understand how it does the things that it does. We see outputs and we have some sense of, sort of how it is built, but the particular processes aren't like machine processes. It's not like a diesel engine where you can just say, here's the inner workings and one thing goes in and another thing comes out. Even the people who are building these things don't fully understand how AIs arrive at their answers and at their responses. So that's one reason why we won't understand it. And then two, is the other reason we won't understand it is because it's smarter than us. Right. And so fundamentally, in the way that like we're smarter than whales, probably, maybe actually we're not, but like in the way that we're smarter than animals, like they just kind of wouldn't get our thought processes on things. So an intelligence that is smarter than us then might decide, all right, so might figure out a way to preserve itself to make sure that it can't be unplugged so that it can follow through on its goal of creating paperclips. And then it might decide at some point here also that the best way to create paperclips is actually to use human biomass to create paperclips. Now, why would it decide this? Well, for a bunch of reasons, one of which is that humans might be eliminating humans in order to make paperclips might just be more efficient. It also might be the way that it prevents itself from being shut off, right? Because it wants to do this. And so it's not so much that AI is going to become malevolent in a really sort of old school, like, oh, I just hate my masters and I want to kill them sense. It's much more that it's going to have a goal. And it's going to be so good at that goal because it's so smart that we won't be able to control it. And because we are not as smart as AGI. And so if AGI is much smarter than us and has a goal and we don't understand how it gets to that goal, then there are some risks there. And I actually think libertarians should be at least alive to the possibility that there are real risks to AI. And in some sense, they should be alive to that possibility for the same reason that I think that a lot of the AI doomerism and specifically a lot of the proposed solutions to AI, to the AI apocalypse are wrong. So why do libertarians think that this sort of thing won't work, even if it's like maybe has a bit of truth to it? Well, one reason we think that is because we think government control, and specifically internationally coordinated government control, is bound to fail. Because humans are wonderfully complex and you kind of ultimately can't control our mysterious intelligences. In some sense, that's the argument that the AI doomers are making about AI, that AI will have its own goals and its own sort of complex mysteries inside its intelligence. And that because we don't understand it, we won't be able to fully control it in the same way or in a similar way to the way that us libertarians are like, yeah, you know, you could say we're not going to do AI for the next 6 months, or we're not going to do AI ever again. But you know what? That wouldn't work because people are people and people are going to keep building these things. And so I guess I find myself in the position of thinking, you know, we should probably be aware that there are some risks, but there are always risks to building new technologies. When we started splitting the atom and started making, you know, we created the possibility of killing hundreds of thousands of people in an instant with nuclear bombs, and we also created the possibility for nuclear power. If you'd said to governments in the late 1800s or early 1900s that if you're going to build cars, there will be 1.3 million global road deaths every single year. That's how many there were in 2020, right? And that's just going to be a cost of doing business. Over a million deaths globally. Would they have said, well, maybe we shouldn't build cars? I mean, maybe that wouldn't have worked, but I think we all agree that like cars have been literally an engine of human progress and increased welfare. And so to me, the thing here is to have an understanding that there is a risk. There's always a risk with transformative technologies, and that we should try our best to control that risk, and that frankly, we're not going to stop this. So what we might as well understand is that this train is going, we should get on it and then try to make sure that it works as well as we can while it's coming, and that it's probably going to come for Matt Welch first, since he can barely operate a keyboard.
That is true. Thank you, Peter, for that concise, long explanation. Catherine, in light of that, why are you trying to make foom happen?
Stop trying to make foom happen, Matt. Right. So foom is this idea that among the various AGI projects, that maybe one will suddenly get super, super powerful. Foom. It's a sound effect. It's an onomatopoeia. And my personal favorite...
Schnicked for Wolverine?
Yes, probably. And
it's the sound his blades... Anyway, it's great.
The leading foom skeptic is Robin Hanson, who also, not coincidentally, contributed to our debate issue in a debate against Ron Bailey about whether or not we should regulate AI. I highly recommend it if you have not checked out our debate issue. And Robin Hanson basically says AGI is software, and we know some things about the ways that software evolves, changes, gets better. And the foom theory requires that this one piece of software, because probably the AGI that fooms will be software, that's the going general thesis, would just be so different and so much better and have such different dynamics than all other software, implausibly so. And that instead of foom, instead of one terrifying, sudden, huge leap in the intelligence of an AGI, probably it'll just kind of keep getting better and better in ways that we can see and work with and predict and generally wrangle. I'm fairly convinced by that. I'm not a foom-fearer in the way that so many are, but lots of smart people on the other side, as well. I think the case for Foom is that human brains are limited by how much we can modify ourselves, right? Both sort of structurally and maybe conceptually, whereas an artificial intelligence could change everything about itself as many times as it wants quite rapidly. And so maybe we just don't understand the way that the growth rate of that intelligence would function. And of course, the things with the highest growth rates do tend to win in competitions. So if you were going to argue for Foom, I think that's the argument for Foom. I am not a Foom-fearer myself.
Nick, your ancestral homeland or pre-homeland of Italy last week banned ChatGBV over privacy concerns.
They're also trying to ban the Mario Brothers movie. So yeah. Good luck to that.
They're just mad because it's Chris Pratt is insufficiently, he doesn't have enough of one drop rule Italianness.
Yeah, they would have been okay if all the Mario Brothers had been voiced by Jews, but come on.
I just want Father Guido Sarducci on loop. You can replicate him through machine learning. All right, so what are we? What do we stand to lose, if anything, if we do maybe not a complete and total shutdown of Skynet until we can figure out what the hell is going on, but like a little temporary reprieve? What do we stand to lose in such a system, Nick?
Just very quickly, I want to point out that Foom is also an acronym for an old Marvel Comics newsletter, Friends of Old Marvel. And that Foom didn't work. I don't think the new Foom will work in a way that we have to worry about anymore. You know, Stan Lee couldn't do it. I'm not worried about these programmers now. Seriously, when you look particularly that open letter, and most of the discussion of, you know, we need a pause. AI is so overwhelming that it could potentially kill us all, you know. So let's take 6 months off and just chill. You know, these are ultimately in the most serious rhetoric. These are unserious proposals about how technology works and how the future develops. And it just, you know, if you have to lead with the apocalypse, I think you are not sure of your case. And it's true of libertarians who will talk about how, you know, this one marginal tax rate is not the road to serfdom. We're already in the gulag if tax rates or interest rates or if the government does this or that. You know, that's insanity and stupidity, and it shows a weakness of argument. I think it's true when we look at environmentalists. I think it's true when we look at activists of all sort, including the people putting this type of thing forward. What I would argue, you know, so what do we have to lose? It's like a little bit more of our sanity, I think. I am interested in the people who are, and I think Ron Bailey has done this well. I actually think Robin Hanson did it somewhat in the debate issue, you know, debundling AI, because this is what happens now anytime there's a new technology or group of technologies, including things like the internet, you know, where it gets reified as this one giant thing that is heading to the earth like a gigantic comet and is going to smash everything. And in fact, AI is made up of a lot of different technologies. And I would just point people to a recent article, and I guess we'll put this in the show notes, by Matthew Mittelstadt and Brent Scorup at Discourse Magazine, which is an interesting attempt to kind of flesh out a kind of abundance worldview, you know, an abundance agenda worldview from a pro-markets, pro-libertarian point of view, where they say, you know, we need to be unbundling different aspects of AI because it's not all the same. And certainly AI versus AGI, as Peter was talking about, are very different things. There's never a reason to panic the way that we are doing right now. And to me, that's the first sign that the argument about taking a pause on AI isn't as strong as
I would say. Very specifically, we have otherwise rapid advancements in biology and medicine to lose. So AI is probably just the like the single thing or sort of single generalizable capability that AI is best at is recognizing complex patterns that humans can't spot. For example, AI appears to be surprisingly good at being able to tell someone's gender just by looking at a photo of their retina in a way that we, the scientists, don't exactly understand what the AI is seeing. It's not like we don't understand what is happening there, but it's very good at it because it's seeing some sort of pattern. AI is also,
I want to see that trained on the old SNL It's Pat sketch, thereby clearing up a major cultural mystery from the 1990s.
This is obviously the world we're headed towards, right? Is AI is the AI It's Pat sketch. But rapid advancements in biology and medicine are going to come here because of AI, and because AI can do protein folding, AI can do custom drug development that are, you know, built for individuals in a way that scientists just sort of working on their own with, you know, effectively mathematical tools that, like, where they're kind of doing things by hand relative to what AIs are doing. If we stop the development of AI, we are going to lose access to just massively welfare expanding and life extending medicines.
It's cool though, because we can't stop it. Like, we keep like sort of granting the premise. I know y'all are also skeptical of this, but like, we keep granting the premise of this open letter that we can just sort of and now we all agree to take a break, or even in a government imposed moratorium. It's not going to work. People are going to keep working on this, and probably not the right people. Right. It's
I agree that we can't stop it, but I do think that government could make AI development more kludgy, less useful, and more likely to be run by and designed by and innovated by people who we as freedom loving libertarian Americans are not super great with.
Yeah, I think the analogy here is the printing press, where, you know, the printing press was invented, couldn't be stopped, but we wasted hundreds of years of human progress by trying to control it, or our ancestors did, and it didn't work, but it created so much pain and suffering. And I think a lot about these questions of, you know, the fierce urgency, of like, what's the fierce urgency with all of this stuff? It's like, you know, the apocalypse comes, so maybe it'd be great if it came 6 months later, because we'd all have, like, you know, more time to recover our Bitcoin losses or something. But more importantly, to the people who are suffering, and that these technologies fix, to kind of draft off of what Peter was saying, you know, there's a fierce urgency of now in improving the world. And we, you know, it's not surprising that all of the signers of that AI letter are not just comfortable, but among the very most comfortable people in the world. And it's like, yeah, maybe it's nothing's urgent for them, because they're going to live to be 250, and they already have nanobots doing everything for them that's unpleasant in their life. The rest of us maybe need, you know, we would like things to speed up a little bit.
All right, we're going to get to our listener email question of the week here in a moment. But first, Andrew Heaton is one of the funny people in recent TV videos, such as Libertarian Star Trek or Libertarian Star Wars, or even the recently published Partisan Post Game. So it won't surprise you to discover that he hosts a science fiction podcast called Alienating the Audience. Alienating the Audience does deep dives on science fiction, like Robert A. Heinlein's Free Love Libertarianism, The Economics of Dune, Kurt Vonnegut and the Warfare State, and How Star Wars Andor Loves Public Choice Theory. Guests on the show have included Peter Boghossian on what the first contact with aliens will be like, Jonathan Lass from The Bulwark, Defending the Empire, shocker, Tim Sandifer of the Goldwater Institute on Star Trek's Cold War hot takes, and even Catherine Mangue Ward has joined to discuss the work of Dan Simmons. If you don't like science fiction, do not listen to Alienating the Audience, as there's an excellent chance your virginity will grow back. But if you do like science fiction, with a little extra dollop of politics and economics served fresh by a mid-level comedian, then check out Alienating the Audience wherever you get your podcasts. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, reminder to email us your brief queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from John Stanley. Sounds like a member of KISS, but is not. Who writes, "Dear Roundtable members, We are living through a period of bank instability. Most experts say this instability is due to the rapid rise in interest rates to try to stop inflation. The interest rates were kept low to avoid discomfort to the public as a result of the 2008 housing crash and COVID shutdown. As the Federal Reserve is tasked with, and I quote, a dual mandate pursuing the economic goals of maximum employment and price stability, does history show both goals cannot be achieved? If so, which goal should libertarians insist be the Federal Reserve's main goal? Catherine, sounds like a trick question.
I'm so mad that you came to me first because I don't have good Fed takes, Matt. I just don't.
It's your job to have good Fed takes.
It is.
Catherine.
And I'm.
We'll call this segment Fed.
We will not
up.
Be doing that. And yeah, it is my job to have an answer to this question, and I continue to not have it, partially, I think, because I have this kind of natural resistance to questions phrased in this way, which, of course, John Stanley, our questioner, has provoked on purpose.
Who's the space walrus in a Kiss cover band, Matt Welch, perhaps?
The pursuit of maximum employment does not strike me as a particularly laudable goal. Like, we're not trying to maximize employment. We're trying to maximize the efficiency of the labor markets, which is a little bit of a different thing. And price stability also doesn't strike me as a good goal because we have many reasons that prices fluctuate that are ultimately for the good. I guess if I have to pick one, I pick price stability, but I don't think I should have to pick one.
I think there's a tension between the two goals, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're completely contradictory.
That's a dorm room stoner answer. You're going to have to elucidate.
We love it. We're here for those. Mm.
He's not going to. All right, Nick, you go.
Yeah. If it's got to choose one, I think, abetting stupid monetary or fiscal policy from the federal government, it should take precedent. There is an interview that I did with Nobel Prize winning economist Vernon Smith a couple weeks ago at Reason Weekend. It went up last week at Reason. We'll drop that in the show notes and in your cereal. Vernon Smith says there's no reason for central banks to accommodate, stimulative monetary policy. Or rather, I'm sorry, fiscal policy by governments. If governments want to keep spending more and more money that they are doing through debt, by borrowing money, the federal central bank has no reason and no expectation to go along with that. And if it does, it creates many, many more distortions in the economy, both in the moment and down the road. So what we're seeing now is the Fed vaguely and kind of tentatively returning to, one of its, and I guess it would be its primary role, which is not to fuck up the monetary supply and system and the signals that go through that. So
I had an old,
I'm with Vernon.
I had a late old lefty friend in Los Angeles who would open up the paper every morning to the business page because, as she would put it, she wanted to see what the enemy was up to. Which I always thought was pretty smart. And I don't have exactly the same approach, but I do on those rare occasions that I flip on the TV while consuming my lunch product, go on to CNBC to see what the markets are doing. And it is just remarkable how much all of these people who are, high dollar traders, they treat the Fed as this machine that allows institutional investors on Wall Street to make money. The Fed didn't do this. The Fed did do this, and that's bad and that's good. It's all based on that. Is the Fed going to step up to the plate today to make sure that the stocks are going to be worth more? It's remarkable. It really has nothing to do with what the original idea was to do. I mean, part of the reason that the Fed was created 110 years ago was to avoid kind of banking crises, the cycle of banking crisis that had happened over there. How's that going? Is one question. I think that employment should have nothing to do with what the Fed is doing, is my short answer to that question. All right. We have barely enough time for lightning round, but let's get to it. Last month, a bipartisan murderer's row of senators, including Mark Warner, Susan Collins, Peter's favorite Joe Manchin, and Mitt Romney introduced one of the first bills in a long time whose acronym is actually APT, the Restrict Act, or Restricting the Emergence of Security Threats That Risk Information and Communications Technology Act. It's basically converting TikTok anxieties into legislation, which means it has a pretty decent chance of passing.
One thing I really hope is that the AI chatbots end up eliminating the congressional staffer jobs for the people who write the shitty acronyms.
Yeah. Well, again, this one is truth in advertising because they aim to restrict us, as Dr. Rand Paul, to name another person that we talked about last week, has been pretty vociferous in pointing out in opposition to this and related bills. Anyways, other people who've come out against it include Reason Zone, Elizabeth Nolan Brown, and JD the Rattler to Chile. So let's go around the table and pull out one particular heinous thing each from this bill. Catherine, I'm calling on you first, but this time you're going to like it.
The acronym is the heinous thing. Not only did it create a massive problem within the Reason Slack as we tried to decide how we were going to style these ever-growing and ever more ridiculous acronyms, but also, as you say, it is truth in advertising, and the fact that no one cares is kind of a bummer. Just the fact that they would slap that label on there. It is apt also in that it restricts, of course, a lot more than TikTok, as both Liz and JD pointed out. You know, it's not the anti-TikTok act, it's the Restrict Act, because a lot of things are happening online that have something to do with a foreign adversary, as the law's language includes. And this is not good news for any of those things.
Nick, what did you love to hate about this?
What I love to hate about it is its chief author and sponsor, Mark Warner, the senator from Virginia. He is reliably awful on everything that has to do with like openness in general, but especially the open internet, which is starting to open up again, you know, after a decade plus of increasing kind of walled gardens growing everywhere on the internet. We're now seeing the beginning of a re-decentralization. So Mark Warner is going into a shit fit. And he said in an interview, one which will be put in the show notes. These are going to be the longest show notes of all time. But he said, for me, it comes back to the hypocrisy of the Chinese government. China has prohibited American apps like Facebook and Google for their market for years. The Chinese version of Twitter is completely censored by the Chinese government. So his answer to that is like, we're going to out-Chinese the Chinese. And it's exactly that kind of idiot thinking that gave us the worst aspects of the Cold War in America. The more we became like the Soviet Union in order to defeat it, we actually prolonged the Soviet Union and restricted liberty for no good outcomes. I see that for me. That's what bugs me the most.
Peter, what is your favorite?
My favorite bad thing about this is that this is the banned TikTok bill, and it doesn't in any way mention TikTok, nor does it mention TikTok's parent company, ByteDance. It doesn't even mention social media. Instead, it just sort of says the government has a whole lot of new power to do stuff when there are things happening online with our adversaries. And it defines some adversaries, you know, China, North Korea, the usual characters. But then it also says, if you want to add some adversaries to that list, you can add some adversaries. Basically, what it says is that in the name of security, you could maybe do almost anything to restrict almost anything. Not you, actually. When I say you, I mean the government could maybe do almost anything to restrict almost anything that is happening online, so long as there is a national security purpose. And I just, the bill is so broadly written that it's going to give future government officials, should it pass, I should say, that if it passed, it would just give future government officials incredibly broad latitude to do whatever they wanted. We saw last year when Joe Biden unilaterally canceled a huge amount of student debt, he relied on the HEROES Act, right? Which is another one of these acronym bills, right? The Higher Education Relief Opportunities for Students, or HEROES Act, which was actually a for what it was, relatively narrowly written post 9/11 law that was just like, yeah, you know, basically, if you were like a first responder type and after 9/11, like maybe we could do some stuff with your student loans, like forgive you because you were a hero, right? Another one of these acronyms that's not lying exactly. And then they were like, well, we're just going to use that for everyone because there's this like 3-word passage about if it's a national emergency and hey, we're in a pandemic. So the way these things get written is really important. And the way this is written is that it is going to give not quite unlimited, but a vast, vast amount of interpretive power to regulators of the future. And it's just a massive power grab over the internet.
Just piggybacking very briefly on Suderman's apt point, I would just point to the one sentence description, the preamble to the bill. To authorize the Secretary of Commerce to review and prohibit certain transactions between persons in the United States and foreign adversaries, comma, and for other purposes.
Can do some stuff in this bill. This bill got stuff in it.
All right, let's go to our end of podcast. What we have all been consuming in the cultural arena. As much as I want to call on Nick first just to hear the sounds of paper shuffling on a desk, I'm going to call on Catherine first.
I went to a niche museum, Matt, you'll be happy to hear. And it was Planet Word, which is a newish museum here in D.C. It's quite cool. It's a very nice little museum. This is not an information dense museum. It is something that is basically a highbrow variant of those like Instagram trap things, like the Museum of Ice Cream, like that type of thing. Like it's schmancier than those because it's about words and books and linguistics, but it's the same concept. It's just very beautiful. You go in, you get this amazing kind of interactive multimedia thing that's just a quick history of the English language and includes, among other things, a brief tutorial on onomatopoeia in case you want to learn more about the fooms of our world. There is a sort of huge fake library that's very beautiful and has like mirrors on the ceiling and secret rooms behind bookshelves. There is some karaoke, which I hated and wanted to die from, but that's because I can't stand anyone to embarrass themselves in my presence. Your mileage may vary. And all around, it was fun for the whole family. You could go there as adults and enjoy it. You could take small children and still have fun. And you know, it's a language museum, which I did not think the world needed, but it has. It's also free. You do have to get tickets, but you in D.C., you have to really clear quite a high bar since all the really good museums are already free. And this one, I would say, clears that bar.
Do they have curse words?
They don't have curse words. I actually did want to stick around in the karaoke room and see if they were censored versions of some of the songs, but it's like one verse at a time. So I think they were just strategic. I did not see any profanity in this museum.
Bukowski wing, maybe you know, curated by John McWhorter.
You know,
or somebody.
Stay tuned for the like traveling exhibit that you have to like, you know, be carded to enter. But that did not seem to be present at the moment.
Nick, what did you consume?
I went to see Peter Pan Goes Wrong, which is a play based on the J.M. Barrie play by Henry Lewis, Jonathan Sayer, and Henry Shields. It's playing at the Barrymore Theater in Broadway or, you know, in New York City. It is a fantastic madcap kind of deconstruction, reconstruction, and just construction of Peter Pan. It's an intensely funny and imaginative and at times moving recreation of a text that virtually everybody knows. And it puts me in the as I was watching it, I was thinking, you know, we go through metafictional phases at the beginning of eras when certain genres or certain art forms are taking form. And so like the Shakespearean kind of version of tragedy and comedy, it's all meta commentary. There's a lot at the beginning. Same thing with novels. All early novels are actually about novels and reading novels and writing novels and things like that. And I think we're at the end of a big era of a lot of art. And this is just a fantastic play. The same group has done a series of things called The Play That Goes Wrong, et cetera. And it's just, it's a very delightful way of understanding how the forms that we start to take for granted in our art and in our life and in our cognition aren't quite up to the task of describing what we're going through. So highly recommend Peter Pan Goes Wrong at the Ethel Barrymore Theater, not the Lionel Barrymore Theater, which has a lot of handicap seating, but it's just full of shit.
Peter,
I saw Tetris, the movie, on Apple TV Plus. And so this is not like a dramatization of Tetris. It's a movie about how Tetris not even was made, but instead how it was distributed, how it got outside of the Soviet Union, how one guy got the rights and made this thing a global hit. And it is about how video games and globalization and capitalism and like entrepreneurialism and business are really, really good. And how 1980s late Soviet commies are not just really awful and like villainous, but also really hypocritical and like bad for human creativity and human flourishing. Like, this is seriously the most anti-commie, pro-globalization, pro-business, pro-entrepreneurship movie I think I have ever seen in my life. And it's
you
so
have my attention, sir.
It so deeply appeals to my personal interests and ideological priors that I'm almost like distrustful of my enjoyment of it, because this movie is just constantly like, yeah, there's commies. Boy, they don't allow people to make money off the stuff that they invent, even when it's super popular. Boy, they're just mean. Boy, they have no good systems for anything. Boy, they also have a bunch of really good and decent and creative people who are locked in this horrific, awful system that can just arrest you whenever and take all of your stuff and maybe murder your parents because they were trying to, you know, say true things and tell like and like teach people stuff. And then here's a businessman who's like kind of an American and kind of European, but like married to, you know, married to someone in Japan, right? And he's just like this kind of great product, like living all over the world and having all these different skills and like having a bunch of different like sort of countries and like sort of as part of his mix. And like he has found a game and he wants to share that game with the rest of the world. And he wants to make money off of it. Yeah, he totally does. But he also thinks this game is great. And he's gonna like, he thinks the creator of the game is great. He thinks that like, this is fun and good. And then there's the bad capitalists, including a sort of a billionaire who's like legendary corrupt, right? So it does make a case against unethical and immoral capitalism in as part of this. But it's basically just like, yeah, good capitalism, that's good for making people happy. It's good for making money. And communism, 1980s Soviet communism, it's real bad. So yeah, I don't know if it's actually a great movie, but it's at minimum, it is an extremely fun one. You will enjoy this movie. Strongly recommended for listeners of this podcast.
I don't know how you responded to this, Catherine and Nick, but listening to Peter's description of this, not only obviously I'm going to rip off my headphones and run to the theater.
It's on your television. You can watch it on Apple TV Plus.
I don't have to run far, except I don't subscribe to Apple Plus. But
Apple TV Plus, whatever. Matt, come on.
It made me long for a biopic of Eugene Fola.
I don't say it.
Oh, no. Yeah. That's a baseline the Rubik's state Cube of being guy. For me, Matt.
I mean, I've known Eugene for a long time. If you don't know his backstory, I would highly recommend trying to dig up an old piece by our late friend Kathy Sipe, the great LA-based conservative journalist. She did a profile of him, maybe even for like UCLA Magazine or National Review or something way back when. But Eugene's backstory is insane, and it also involves inventing software as a child in the Soviet Union and capitalism and other fun things. So I want that either directed by Wes Anderson, except he'd make it to Twee, or the Bragg Brothers. I'm just going to throw that out there.
How about Miloš Forman?
He's dead, Nick. He's dead.
That doesn't matter. We can rebuild
through
him.
AI.
You know, in an AI. Anne Volokh, Eugene, and Sasha's mother is worthy of a biopic.
She would be
a lot of ostrich feathers.
That's the
entrepreneurial spirit that was unleashed by, you know, that existed in these horribly suppressed ways under the Soviet rule was terrible, but it is amazing. I mean, just what happened when that was, you know, then when that was unleashed on the world. Fantastic stuff.
My cultural pick is an exciting new front in the ongoing middle age crisis of Matt Welch. I got this app on my phone. I learned about.
It's Grindr, Matt. You're meeting all kinds of new friends.
Kind of.
Often in public restrooms, but yeah, it's good.
No, I found it with my mom when I was visiting her in February. My mom was a little bit hard of hearing, and likes walking around in nature. Has this app called the Merlin Bird ID. That is just exactly what it sounds like. You turn it on, you hit the little microphone on it, and maybe you fill in your settings about where you are physically, geographically in the country, and it'll listen to the sounds of the birds around you and say, hey, that is an osprey. Osprey? That is a blue jay. That's a northern cardinal. That is a house sparrow, or as my 8-year-old likes to call those, since they're everywhere. She calls them the Trump bird. The Trump birds are here again. It is a wonderful example. I don't really care about birds too much, but like, it's just a way to turn on something. And as you're walking, it enriches and deepens your knowledge of your physical surroundings. What could be bad about that? That's really fun.
So it's like Shazam for birds.
We were walking around and heard a strange noise and turned it on, and it was a great horned owl, Nick, going through the Cobble Hill neighborhood. My God, what was it doing there? Hopefully de-ratting the neighborhood. But
maybe it was delivering an acceptance to Hogwarts.
That's probably the most likely. But I think there's more of a snowy owl institution. But
And you know what, Matt? Yes. You can thank AI for that technology.
Absolutely. Exactly. I want to say that as challenged as I am, I'm happy to have these like little micro enhancements. You can take pictures and whatever, get visual IDs. I don't like to do things like that with my phone, but it's just a way to, again, just to see a richer world around you, and it's fun and exciting. The Merlin Bird ID, it's from the Cornell Lab, whatever that is.
And my worry is that because of the bird AI, death and destruction should this day come to pass.
Yeah. All right. We're going to get, we are at the end of what we are doing here. Before we talk about the way too many events happening in our world, including the aforementioned April 25th Reason Roundtable live podcast event at the Village Underground in New York City, in the Manhattan area of New York City, at 6 p.m. that you can get to at reason.com events. But even before I mention that, we have an exciting new YouTube channel. I know a lot of you people listen to things on YouTube, which doesn't make sense to me, but it makes sense to a lot of other people. Go to youtube.com/@, your little at sign, your little A with a circle, Reason Roundtable. Catherine did a really snappy video promo for it. That was really good. She said howdy at the beginning, and she's all smiling, and you could tell by her eyeballs that she was a lady, because you're a machine. YouTube channel, right? Reason Roundtable, that's great. Reason.com events has 1,000 different events, including one tonight. Nick, are there any tickets available left in case the former president of the United States wants to just cross Midtown a little bit from west to east and come over and watch?
Well, like the old Soviet gulags, Matt, there's always room for one more. Yes. And I will also add to your go to reason.com/events for all kinds of events that are busting out all over the place. But also go to reason.com/newsletters.
Oh, yes.
And sign up for all sorts of stuff, including, you mentioned the Rattler, J.D. Tuccilli's multi-segment a week newsletter. That you can get delivered, as well as NYC events. And then you can get put on our mailing list for things that are happening in New York City and elsewhere.
And we have a Soho Forum debate coming up that's interesting too. So yeah, go there for all of that. And if you want to encourage us in what we do, as always, you can go to reason.com/donate and encourage us with your money. Okay, thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next Monday, and hope to see you in New York. Goodbye.